It's lovely you're all here. Sorry, it's the last event of the season. But it'd be nice having a break as well, isn't it? And what a lovely evening it is. Rain. Where would we be without rain? And wind, cold wind, dark. And then the contrast, lovely and warm, full of light inside. How marvellous. I hope you're all feeling warm enough and light enough. So tonight I wanted to talk about, I don't quite know what to call the talk, something like flow, something like that. It's Christmas coming up. Yeah, a few of you not looking so happy about that, but beautiful time of year. Goodwill to all. Time for friendliness and fun with friends and family. Yep, I can see I'm selling this well. But it is, it's a beautiful time of year, isn't it? Lovely time of year, we get to swap presents and appreciate each other. It's great, it's lovely. And what makes it even more special this year, of course, is we've had a political general election. And wasn't it fabulous and marvellous that they decided to conduct the election in the spirit of Christmas? I've never known an election where people were so joyous, so happy, so friendly. Good luck, Boris. Good luck, Jeremy. Everyone was just so, oh, hang on, I see what I'm doing there. I'm imagining life to be different than it is. It was, in fact, perhaps in my lifetime, certainly, perhaps in yours too, probably the angriest general election I can remember. Certainly, there was so much vitriol, is that the word? There was so much unpleasantness, especially online, so much anger, people being dismissed, people being told that they are awful people, deplorable, all this kind of thing going on. Which is, that's life. That's the way it is. Cool, I can see how the atmosphere has just come down. I'm not sure too. But you start to investigate it. One thing that interested me was that there's this call for politics to be kinder, to be more gentle, for people to be kinder, gentle, and more tolerant. But that is something that is being compelled onto people rather than it being something which is undertaken oneself. So when the results came in and it turned out that people hadn't voted in the way that certain people wanted them to vote, there was all this anger and vitriol and hatred. But if you look at it more deeply, it's like you ask yourself, well, what is it that people see? What is it they want life to be? And so there's this, all right, admittedly an idealistic view of life where people have equal opportunity, their differences are tolerated, that they're not penalised through things over which they cannot possibly help, and that everyone has got enough food, everyone's got enough chance in life to go out and succeed and have happy, fulfilling lives. Which, it's fair enough, isn't it? But that requires everyone. It requires reality to conform to that ideal. So the whole of reality has to conform to those ideas. So if somebody is not conforming, then we've got problems. If someone has different ideas about how life should be or how we should proceed, then that becomes then intolerable. That's why we start to get these conflicts. And of course, trying to bend reality to your will, to your ideas, is a loser right from the start, isn't it? It's never going to happen. You're never going to make life exactly what to conform to what you want it to be. So it's inevitable that it generates conflict. But if you look at that aspiration slightly more deeply and say, okay, so why do you want life to be like that? Well, I want life to be like that, so then there aren't any problems in the world. And if there aren't any problems in the world, I can be happy. I can get on with what I would like to do, free of wanting life to be different than it is. It's kind of ironic, isn't it? So what is it that people actually want? They want the state free of wanting. They want life to be this dynamic flow where they can just spontaneously be themselves and go through life without fear, without insecurity, without anxiety, without wanting life to be different than it is. Now, in Buddhism, we call that nibbana. That's the state free of wanting and not wanting. The state of free flow of experience, stymied by that passionate desire for life to be different than it is. And so we discover that everyone wants the same thing, it's just the means is different. And the Buddha's teaching most definitely goes against the flow of that worldly outlook and that worldly attempt to realize freedom from suffering. The Buddha discovered, his great discovery, that free flow, that spontaneous unfolding of experience, free from craving, free from resistance, free from wanting and not wanting, is actually our natural state. So the thing that everyone wants, we actually have. And what stops us from recognizing it is the very wanting and not wanting, trying to control, trying to manipulate, trying to change, trying to make it the thing that you want it to be. In the absence of all of that, you've got this lovely free flow to life. And it's dynamic. It's not like a dead fish going downstream. It's dynamic, it's alive, and it's mysterious, and it's everything you wanted it to be. So the Buddha discovered that because people fail to recognize the fundamental truths and laws and processes that go to make life up, it's out of the not seeing that, the not understanding the true nature of reality, that that is the basis for then passionately craving to try to make life right. So the whole process of Buddha's teaching is going in a different direction to that worldly direction. It is, in essence, it is learning how to stop misaligning, how to stop falling into that passionate resistance, how to let all that passionate resistance go, and therefore be left in the moment, in the here and now, and able to explore, investigate, observe how life is actually put together. So it's a wisdom teaching. So developing that wisdom within oneself to truly understand life and unlock that spontaneous flow which is our true nature. And it's, yes, this is something that has been concerning me, because when I talk to meditators, one of the prime issues, I think, for everyone is the absence of happiness and joy when we're meditating. When we are in alignment with the way life really is, when we're not misaligned, when we're in alignment with it, life is spontaneously peaceful, happy. Sometimes it's even joyful, blissful. And then when we passionately crave for life to be different than it is, that's when we misalign. So we go from coherence to interference. We go from alignment to misalignment. We go from the light into the dark. And to be able to meditate successfully, we need to be in the light. We need to be in coherence. We need to be in alignment with the flow of life as it's unfolding so that we can investigate. If you're happy, you're aligned. If you're unhappy, you want life to be different than it is, you're misaligned. So my thinking is, what leads to a happy outlook? What leads to a happy, joyful outlook? So that when you sit down to meditation, you do so fully aligned to life, not misaligned. You're in the flow, not trying to get in the flow. You see the difference? So when we're practicing hindrances, we fall out of the flow. When we notice that we're running hindrances, and we hate ourselves for it, we're even further out of alignment. But we need to be in alignment. We need to allow this spontaneous flow of conscious experience to occur. So my thinking is, how do you bring about that state of happiness? And the answer, by following the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path. Of course it is. So it's got three elements to it. It's got living an ethical life. It's got mental development, learning how to be mindful, concentrate, essentially learning how to be happy, in order to then gain wisdom through observation, investigation into the true nature of existence. Okay, so this is going in a completely different direction to everyone who's trying to control and manipulate the world. Okay. And what I discovered was, when I was thinking about this, is that every component of the Buddha's teaching is designed specifically to bring you into alignment, to bring you out of misalignment and bring you into alignment. For example, when we practice keeping the precepts, five precepts, refraining from killing or harming living creatures, refraining from taking that which is not given, refraining from sexual misconduct, refraining from all forms of wrong speech, refraining from intoxicating drinks and mind-altering drugs. By adhering to those precepts as much as we can, we are bringing our actions into alignment with the way life works. We're coming out of misalignment and coming into alignment with work, because the principle upon which all the precepts turn is the law of karma, the fact that our actions have results. So it is inevitable that if we break precepts, if we indulge in those kinds of activities, that will have a detrimental effect on our ability to be happy. If we keep precepts as much as we can, and I've got Christmas Day in mind, let's hope we don't break all five. That's we've got to be pragmatic about it. If you're breaking all five routinely on Christmas Day, I really think you've got some work to do, definitely. But yeah, let's be reasonable about it. If we keep the precepts most of the time, we find as a result we are happier. We are more in alignment with the way life works. We are accepting the fact that our actions have results, which is a basic principle of the Buddha's teaching, which is a description of reality. So we find that the results of keeping the precepts are more happiness, more joy, more light, less dark. Oh, and I should say to round it out also, the other side, which is the actual performance of positive, compassionate activities, acts of service. So, no, it's okay, I'll deal with Christmas dinner, or whatever it might be, you know, it's like, I'll wash up, you know. Little acts of service, little acts of generosity, little acts of putting yourself out for the benefit of others, those two will bring more alignment. Again, you're aligning with the basic fundamental law that our actions have results. So, although there might be, you know, a sense of suffering in the performance of that selfless act, actually the results are that you feel a lot better, you feel a lot happier. As a result. So it makes sense. And I think we all know that in our experience, don't we? Then we come on to mental development, and this is where I started to appreciate how much the Buddha's teaching is about appreciating life, And I think learning to appreciate life will bring a tremendous amount of happiness and joy to anyone's life. It's so easy to look on the dark side. Yes, there is another Star Wars movie out. So I shouldn't have mentioned that. I've got to move past that, Richard. You can dwell on the dark side. The more you dwell on what is wrong and what is missing in your life, the darker your life will become. The more angry you'll become, the more resentful you'll become, the more painful and depressing life will become. Or you can choose to appreciate life. And so much of the practices that we engage with are about appreciation. Let's look at the divine abidings. Loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Loving kindness. Thinking about the good qualities of a person and wishing them well. So appreciation of that person. So there's Granny on Christmas Day. And we love Granny. We love Granny. She smells all soapy. And she can really knock back the claret. I'm not quite sure about the cigars, but she says they put hair on her chest. So. But we love Granny, the way she falls asleep the moment the Queen's speech starts. You know, we love Granny, don't we? Yeah. So that's an appreciation of Granny. And then you wish Granny well. You know, maybe she's well and happy. May her heart's desires be fulfilled. May her lottery numbers finally come up. Yeah, and that's loving kindness. Again, it's not difficult. It's choosing to appreciate. And that is bringing us in alignment with reality. It's bringing us in, because all those things are true about Granny. And it generates a sense of softness and happiness and friendliness. And that's a wonderful thing. Compassion. It's the appreciation is slightly different in all these cases, but the appreciation with compassion is the appreciation of someone's suffering. Appreciation that people do suffer. Why? Because they passionately want life to be different than it is, and you can see examples of that. And so compassion is the appreciation of the truth of the Four Noble Truths, if you like, that passionate resistance does lead to intensification and a magnification of suffering. And then there's the wish that that person be free of their suffering. They'd be free of, you know, their ailments and anxiety and their distress in whatever way, and that they'd be free and happy, enlightened, at peace. So, again, that process of mind, being willing to think in those terms, is in alignment with the way life actually is. So, compassion does not lead to self-pity. True compassion leads to a sense of happiness and joy. A softening of the heart. Sympathetic joy. What do other people do well? Well, that's clearly, you know, especially in regard to a spiritual path like Buddhism, someone's is actually very good at keeping the precept about speech. You very hardly hear a bad word spoken by them. That's an opportunity for sympathetic joy. Again, it's appreciating that person, appreciating what they do well. And that is bringing us into alignment with reality, because that's true. That's actually the sort of states that they produce. And so you acknowledge that and go, yeah, that's a really good thing. Puts you in a good frame of mind. Equanimity. I think equanimity is important. It's sort of side issue here, but I'm going to be talking about how this generating this happiness through appreciating life brings happiness and joy. But I don't want you to think that it's just an endless elevator, an endless escalation of happiness and joy till, I don't know what happens, your brain explodes or something. It's not. Actually, we discover that we end up moving towards equanimity, which is a state free of passion. But with equanimity, the way we bring ourselves in alignment to reality is by recognizing that we all fare on according to our deeds. whether this person is spewing out vicious vitriol or whether they are mild-mannered and peaceful and happy. One isn't better than the other. They're just going to experience the results of their actions, and we will fare on according to our deeds. And that leads to a sense of equanimity, a sense of balance with life. And that's a beautiful thing. And although that doesn't, might not lead to the same degree of happiness, it leads to this beautiful sense of passionlessness, which enables you, not passion for, you know, you have a passion for jigsaws or whatever, I mean, you know, the passionate response, a negative passionate response to life. So all these appreciations are bringing us into line with the laws that govern existence. They're bringing our minds into align with the laws that govern existence. If you practice any of the divine abidings as part of your meditation practice, you will find that over time, that your meditations will become happier. They will become more joyful. The state of mind with which you look at the experience arising and passing away will be one of happiness, joy, or equanimity as a result. In the Buddha's teaching also, we have recollections. And recollections take on many, many different forms. There's the recollection of the Buddha, so that's the sterling qualities of the Buddha, his teaching, the Dhamma, the Sangha. There's also recollections that you can do. There's the unofficial recollection, gratitude. I look back at my life and appreciate the things that people have said and done for me and against me, the things that I've done for people and against people. I look back with appreciation and gratitude towards it all because it's brought me to where I am today. And where I am today is a good place. So I feel very grateful. So I take time to appreciate those things. So any time we are choosing to appreciate, because you could quite easily look back at life with resentment for the things that people did to you. Well, that's going, you know, that's the contrast, that's going into the dark. Does that make you feel better? Does appreciating what people may have done for you in the past make you feel better? Does it bring you more into the light? Then let's go with that. And so this is why mindfulness is so important. This is why when we practice mindfulness, why noting is so important. It's contrast. You have your light states where you're aligned, and you have your dark states where you are misaligned. They are both equally important in meditation. It's not about being always in the light. It's about the contrast and about developing the wisdom to know which you prefer. So it's not wrong that resentment arises about some past thing done to you. It's not wrong. It's only wrong in the sense that if you indulge it, you'll get painful results because you're resisting life, you're not in alignment with life. So the more you recognize that and you actually experience the painfulness of holding on to those kinds of resentments, you go, well, I don't want that, I want the light. Therefore, there is this spontaneous, well, you have to learn it. You learn it the hard way, but gradually you spontaneously let go of those resentments because they're painful, precisely because they're painful, and you let them go and you accept that the past could not have been different than it was. You've learned so much from it. I've learned so much. If you've been holding on to a resentment for years and years and years, and then you discover that the problem is not the original event, the problem is actually you holding on to that resentment, and you let go of that resentment, you end up with appreciation for what that person did in the first place. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for that, because I've learned so much. And this is why contrast is so important, that we recognize that meditation, practicing mindfulness, is about noting everything that arises. And your wisdom is your ability to choose wisely based on the evidence. And so it's a very much an organic change that occurs. You change as your wisdom grows. That's a beautiful thing. And mindfulness in and of itself is an appreciation of reality, isn't it? When we sit and we note, thought, feeling, tactile sensation, on and on. Each time we're doing that, that is an act of appreciation of the true nature of reality. And when you're doing that, you're only a very small moment away from being able to acknowledge the transient nature of that thought, that feeling, that tactile sensation. And so, as your mindfulness deepens, your appreciation of reality as it's unfolding can grow and grow and grow and grow. And what you find with that is that you start seeing, you start appreciating things that previously you had never thought merited your attention at all. And it could be something as easy as, I don't know, slicing up a kiwi fruit and then being sort of just blown away by the pattern that emerges when you look at it. It could be something as simple as hearing the pitter-patter of rain on a window pane. That somehow it grabs you and there's an appreciation of it in a way that you'd never seen before because you've taken the time. Because you're coming out of the misaligned process of wanting life to be different and you're going, well, how is it actually? How is it really? And the universe responds with a sound of pitter-patter of rain on the window pane. And you go, oh my God, that's so beautiful. And so the appreciation grows and grows. And as the appreciation grows and grows, your happiness and your joy grow. Your appreciation of the mystery of life grows. And in contrast, your willingness to be in a state of passionately resisting and wanting life to be different lessens and lessens and lessens. Why would you want to go there? So you find that you prefer being here in the moment, being mindful, appreciating life as it's unfolding, rather than trying to somehow manipulate it into the shape that you want it to be so that you can finally not want anything. So you're gradually letting go of the wanting and preferring to be in a state of neither wanting nor not wanting. You're in a state free of craving by preference because it's happy, it's joyful, it's peaceful. And so you find with meditation that you oscillate. You're there, you're watching the breathing process, you're seeing how each component part of the breathing process is arising and passing away, arising and passing away. And you find yourself worrying about some event that hasn't even happened yet, and you say to yourself, oh, there I go again, imagining life to be different than it is. Why would I want to do that? And you just let it go, and you come back to what you were doing, because you prefer it. And as you're just resting in the moment, not craving, not wanting life to be different than it is, you discover that there is this effortless flow of life unfolding. Consciousness is just unfolding by itself. Feelings, sensations, thoughts are just arising by themselves. Sounds, shape and colour. Everything is just arising and passing away by itself. And you realise that everything is coming together in the moment and passing away in the moment. That life is literally coming into focus, coming into being now, and disappearing each moment, arising and passing away. And yet, it creates such order. So with the spontaneous flow, there is just such order to life. It makes sense. And it doesn't require you to manipulate and hold and control in order for it to be okay. It is spontaneously okay. So appreciation of life brings you into alignment with the way life really is. So anything that you can do, and I've found that the more you do it, because, you know, it's like that, you've got to practice what you preach, yeah? So I've been practicing. Lying in bed, oh, this is a lovely soft mattress. Oh, I'm lovely and warm, toasty. This is nice. Ooh, I'm going to go to sleep, maybe I'll have some dreams. And it's just appreciating, appreciating, appreciating. I mean, I've had moments where a thought has arisen and I've just appreciated the fact that the thought has arisen. When you get to that stage, yeah, it's going well. But the point is, it does produce happiness. The more you appreciate, the more that grows. And not only that, as a final thought, there is this, I've noticed this weird alchemy that happens, that as you're more appreciative of life, life becomes more appreciative of you. And since I started this, I've had so many brilliant comments on YouTube videos and things been left. People say, oh, thanks for this, Paul. Really appreciate this. It's really helped. I'm like, oh, right, okay. So the more you appreciate, it seems the more that is reflected back to you. It becomes very powerful, very powerful. If you want, because the other thought before we finish. Meditation is difficult, it's challenging, but you are allowed to be happy. You are allowed to be happy. And I think there is an issue where people, because there are so many issues, so many apparent problems with life, they feel that it would be wrong to be happy at this time. We can only be happy once all these issues are solved. And to just go around going, when there's, you know, a climate crisis and you know, terrible politics and all the rest of it, to just be sort of bimbling about, sort of going, how are you? Lovely day, isn't it? You know, is deemed to be deeply inappropriate, I guess. But you are allowed to be happy. You are allowed to meditate happily. And it's my experience that if you cultivate appreciation of life, you will find that you will be able to meditate happily. And that will make it so, the difficult process of meditation so much easier.